ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention, please. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this event. It's a joint lecture organized by the seminar of the Finnish Economist Summer Seminar, as well as the Economic and Business History Society. My name is Jari Eloranta. I'm a professor of economic history at Appalachian State University in North Carolina. Also, I'll be starting out as an economic history professor in Helsinki in the beginning of September. Now, when we were thinking about the seminar, we were trying to conceive, what did we want to do? What kind of event did we want to have? And we wanted to have something, we wanted to organize a seminar, an event, an academic dialogue between different disciplines. And I think today's keynote speech will be part of that, as we will have another keynote speech on Friday that will continue this discussion. Now, first, before I go a little further, let me thank all the organizers here, local organizers, University of Jyväskylä, Department of Economics, Department of History and Ethnology, as well as various academic units who have made this possible. In particular, I wanted to thank sincerely Jari Ojala. I think we should give him a hand. Thank you. Also, this could not have been possible without the tireless efforts of the program chair of this event, which is Olli Turunen. Where's Olli? He's back there. Yes. As you know, it takes a village to organize these kinds of events. Now, I wanted to provide a brief introduction to our keynote speaker. And I've introduced her once, by the way, in the past. And it's a very difficult task. First of all, her CV is long. There's all kinds of different things. She's also very multifaceted, scholar, teacher, mentor, and academic. Kind of molded in the Renaissance fashion. You do everything. You're doing discussion studies of English, literature, economics, politics, history, and so forth. So Deirdre McCloskey is embodiment of these kinds of things. She's a distinguished professor of economics, history, English, and communication at the University of Illinois in Chicago. So that kind of tells you something about the breadth of her scholarship. Now, she's been also instrumental in many debates in economics, economic history, which is why she's a great speaker for this event. And our colleagues in economics were particularly interested in her work. She's worked on statistical significance, statistical analysis, how we can use those kinds of methods, or maybe we should be more cautious in using those kind of efforts. And she's published widely on a number of different topics. Now, I wanted to, however, mention very briefly, to keep this short, her recent work, a series of books that have talked about kind of the origins of the Western world. How did it come to be? What were the key ingredients that induced economic growth? Because this is at the heart of the debate about the modern world. And she's published several books, very, very extensive books on this. The Bourgeois Virtue, the most recent one was The Bourgeois Equality. And these books, there's a third one as well, I didn't forget, but these books have kind of, they're talking about the very core debate in economic history, which is the notion of, is it institutions? Is it innovation? What is it that makes economies grow? And in particular, I think she's made a very forceful contribution to make us think about the role of ideas in economic development. So it gives me profound pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Professor Deirdre McCloskey.
I don't know how to do it.
I think there's a button.
Okay, now, yeah, big voice. The microphone is among the oldest electronic technologies. First the telegraph, then the microphone. And yet it usually doesn't work. I do wish, if there are any engineers here, that they stop doing what they're doing and go fix microphones. I've been in Europe for a week, so I'm not... So the incoherence of what I'm about to say, I can't blame on jet lag. I can, though, blame it on jet travel because I lost my notes to my speech in the plane somewhere. I don't know where it is. But it was fresh in my mind, so I think we're going to be all right. I have a speech defect, more superficial, perhaps, than my other defects. So you'll have to grow accustomed to that. Finland is a free country. If you can't stand it, you can run screaming from the room. I won't break down crying. We're here as economists and economic historians and business historians, social historians too. And I ask the question, as we all ask every day, I think, what are we doing and why? What is this inquiry we're engaged on, this historical inquiry? And it must be especially present, this question, and part of its answer, to a Finn, because Finland, a century and a half ago, was one of the poorest places in Europe. The most poor place was Russia, but Finland was part of Russia, as you may recall. And it was unspeakably poor. $1 a day, maybe, in modern terms. $2 a day. I don't need to tell you about the last nationwide or region-wide famine in European history. So it was very poor, and now it's very rich. Now, Finns, I mean, look around you, are well-to-do. Not as vulgar as Americans, but almost as rich as them. And I suggest that that's the question we're mainly concerned with, aren't we? I mean, I got into economics to help the poor, and I still want to help the poor. When I was a young person, I thought the best way of helping the poor was socialism, but I got over that. And then I came to believe that the best way to help the poor is an economy like Finland's, or Japan's, or indeed China's or India's nowadays, United States, whatever. An economy in which, in this cliche of the right, which I don't want to impose on you, but all boats do rise. The poorest, indeed, are the main beneficiaries of modern economic growth. I think that's fair to say. In 1800, most of the world earned $2 a day, maybe $3 in modern terms. Imagine trying to live here on $3 a day. Doesn't look too pleasant. And, of course, there are plenty of countries, as I speak, as we are here, that are still earning and producing and consuming $3 a day or $2 a day. So that's the question, how we got from here to there, because I think more or less everyone here understands that it's completely unique. It's utterly without precedent. In fact, I'm a little doubtful that we should be working so hard as we do. I've worked on it. Many people here have worked on it. About the Industrial Revolution per se. Because there had been earlier industrial uprisings. Jack Goldstone calls them efflorescence. The Song Dynasty in China. Maybe it doubled income the way that the income of England and then Scotland was doubled between, say, 1760 and 1860. But in each of the earlier occasions, again, the discovery and exploitation of the wheat, olive oil, and wine economy of the Western Mediterranean, dominated by Greek merchants, Greek and Phoenician merchants, afterwards it went away. The good emperors of the Roman Empire, about 100 years, resulted in considerable prosperity, which you can document and even sometimes measure, and yet it failed in the end. But there's no sign of this modern increase failing. And its magnitude is far above anything that ever happened before. It wasn't inevitable that the doubling of the Industrial Revolution of income per head was going to continue, but it did. As my friend Joe Mulcair says, the others dribbled out, they dribbled away, but there was something very strange in our modern experience. It continued. In the case of Finland, the increase is not 100% of income per head. It's not a doubling, as desirable as that is. I'd like to double my income. I guess everyone here would. But 3,000%, a factor of 30 increase from 1800 to the present. Do you think? If you're not accustomed to thinking this way, and I think almost everyone here is, but if you're not, you'll say, well, how could it be 30 times? That's crazy. But all you have to do is consider how you got here. By train or car or airplane, all of them miracles. Air-conditioned lights, inexpensive steel, wood. In Scandinavia, it's always wood. But that required the invention of the circular saw and then the band saw and then power for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that that's our central explicandum, as we expert Latinists always call it. Actually, I got that from Alex Gershon-Corona, used to speak about the explicanda or the explicandum. That's what we're all basically focused on, I think. We can have concerns about equality, say, and I understand that, or other aspects of modern economic growth, but its gross size is the biggest scientific problem. Changes in income distribution and the inequality of Europe, which I actually think was greater in 1800 than it is now, is interesting to look into, but it's not the central puzzle of our lives. The first book of my trilogy, The Bourgeois Virtues, attempts to show that this enrichment was not corrupting ethically. But the big scientific question is why it happened at all. Now I'm going to be critical, since we all pretty much agree on this. As the blessed Adam Smith said, we're interested in the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. Well, how do we pursue it? I'd say that most of us, including me in past times, pursue it by looking at, say, one company. If we're business historians, for example, seems a reasonable thing to do, take a piece of this economic organism and examine it carefully. It's well worth doing. We learn a great deal from this. But do we learn about the causes of economic growth? Or take a region, Scania or the Russian area of Finland or the Midwest or something like that, and we study that. Or a nation. This is the most common that we economic historians do. We study a nation. I studied England because my languages were so terrible. I remember Alex Gershenkron sent me to visit David Landis over in the history department. I was in economics. And Alex, I think he knew what would happen. He sent me to visit David to talk about my dissertation on the British iron and steel industry. And I said to Landis, I'm going to do it a comparative study. I'm going to study the comparison between the allegedly failing British iron and steel industry and the allegedly successful American iron and steel industry. And he said, well, you know, a much better comparison would be Germany. Of course you know German. And I said, no, I don't actually know German. And he threw me out of his room. I mean, he didn't actually lay hands on me, but that was the end of the interview. So we study one industry, the British iron and steel industry. And we're trying to infer something about the whole, or a whole nation trying to infer something about the greater whole, which is economic growth in the world. I think economic growth in the world is happening as we speak. I think that within the lifetime of our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren, the whole world will be developed, to take a phrase from another economic historian. But is that the right way to go about it? And I would argue this afternoon that it's not. And here's the reason. The problem is that any one company or any one region or country can expand, can do well by comparison with companies and regions around it, by being a little bit better than their competitors. There's a lot of talk in business schools especially about competitiveness, which for the non-economists here, I bring you news. Competitiveness is not an economic concept. It's a business school concept. It makes a great deal of sense for a single business to worry about its competitiveness. But we talk about the competitiveness of the Finnish economy. It's a rather, from an economist's point of view, strictly economist's point of view, it's a very strange way of talking. Because small advantages can make for big differences in outcomes without the small advantages amounting to very much. This is actually a point that my colleague and friend, the great Robert Fogel, made about the railways. We all know that railways made Chicago compared to St. Louis. St. Louis was at the confluence of two great rivers in the United States, but Chicago was a natural place for the railways to converge. In the old days of when we had serious passenger railways in the United States, don't, by the way, if you've never been to the United States, don't think you can use Amtrak. Europeans say, oh, but the American railway, Amtrak couldn't be as bad as the Italian railways, could it? And I say to them, yes, it's worse. Don't do it. And they say, well, no, see, look at the map. You can go to all these places. No, no, no. Buy a car or fly. Don't use the railways. But in any case, in the old days, before that happened, the talk was of passengers was change in Chicago. Because like Paris and London, Berlin, the railways with their political influence arranged it so you had to change. You had to use the hotels, use the taxi cabs, use the restaurants, and then go west or go east. So a small advantage, it could have been a small advantage for Chicago, made Chicago grow and St. Louis didn't. Well, it's not necessarily the case that because things are shifted from one part of the economy to another, that there's a net gain. The fundamental economic idea of opportunity cost, or resources, if you want to look at it that way, is it means that things are not free. There's no such thing as a free lunch, we used to say at Chicago. I think we still do, or they do. That you transfer resources from what could have been a bigger St. Louis to a still bigger Chicago, there's not necessarily a big gain. There has to be a little gain, or it doesn't happen. But it can be quite small. And that point means that studies that all of us have done, me included, of individual enterprises, individual regions, individual countries, individual industries, as valuable as they are for as input into a grand narrative of how we got so rich, don't answer it. Is Klaus Rundbeck here? Klaus is not here. He's was a colleague of mine in Gothenburg, as we English speakers say, or Jutteborg. And this point of mine comes out of a correspondence I had with Klaus. And Klaus is doing brilliant work on the Baltic economy. And I said to him, Klaus, wait a minute, why does it matter that the Dutch came in and did this, and the Poles did that, and the Swedes did this? How does it contribute to the big story of modern economic growth, the nature and causes, the wealth of nations? And Klaus is very intelligent. He got the point immediately. And that's my point, that although we can kind of we can get nice fellowships from companies to do company histories, and we can get economic history studies of whole nations, and economists are fixated on this whole nation stuff, that's not what we need to know. What do we need to know? Seems to me, and you know, I want there to be a discussion after this. I'm not going to go on and on about this. So as I advise my students, start thinking of questions right now, or objections, don't wait until the end. What do we need? We need to know about the environment, or whatever else it was, not necessarily the physical environment, but the social and political environment, that caused the astonishing explosion of innovation after 1800. It's essentially after 1800 that we have to focus on. You can make the case, as many of my colleagues, especially in British economic history, make, that there's a run-up and that it all starts in the Black Death. For some reason, the Black Death, which hit China harder than Europe, doesn't have the same effect in China. I don't know why. There are all these problems, but it's a very long run-up. And then finally, in the 19th century, there's this takeoff, as Walt Rostow said, into self-sustained economic growth. But I don't think so. I think there's something strange about the 18th century, in northwestern Europe in particular, that is then the cause of this explosion of ingenuity, and that's what made us rich. It's not investment. Here I'm speaking to my economist colleagues. Delta K is not how we got rich. Why not? I mean, you got to have, look, we have this wonderful aula here. All this wonderful, horrible technology. That's capital. And then everyone in this room has human capital, masses of it that we've accumulated. Did you know that the only substantial figure economic historian in literature is in Hedda Gabler, her husband, the economic historian, who studies, I believe, the wool industry of Brabant from 1510 to 1515. And she says to her friend, the judge, "You don't know how awful it is, the wool industry of Brabant, morning, daytime, and evening." And that's kind of my point, that the wool industry of Brabant is not how to do it. As fascinating as I'm sure the wool industry of Brabant is. What we need is to understand the circumstances of why Swedes invented the ball bearing, why English people invented the railway, why German people invented the modern university in 1810, von Humboldt's University of Berlin, why Holland, with its unusually relaxed attitude towards independent women, invented the idea of women being free. Why? Why Italians invented banking, why? All these elements of investment come from ideas. That's the point of the third volume of my trilogy. That once you've got the idea of the railway and you've shown, as Stevenson did, that it worked, then getting the investment is not the constraint. It's easy. Nokia, I know it's a sensitive point in Finland, gets the idea of the smartphone, or the phone especially, that maybe was their problem, then they've got this wonderful opportunity. It's very easy to get people to invest in it. And this has been true. We discovered in British economic history in the 1950s, contrary to what, I don't know, Marx's conception of this, you didn't need an original accumulation of capital for the cotton textile industry to be financed. I was talking on the plane to a guy who does insurance worldwide for the for trade credit. And it was trade credit, 90 days, from suppliers and demanders of cotton, and demanders of cotton textiles that held up the industries of Manchester. You didn't need the big investments you need for railways, for example. The age of capital, as my former colleague Eric Hobsbawm said, was brief, in my opinion. It was the railway age, the electrification age, that's what made for the necessity to have big amounts of capital. It's not that capital is unimportant, you need it more or less every time, but it's rather easy to get if you've got a good idea. So the question is, where did the good ideas that have enriched us come from? What were the social and political and psychological circumstances? Now, as far as psychology is concerned, I think that's barking up the wrong tree, as we say in the south of the United States. It's an image, by the way, of dogs chasing squirrels, and the squirrels have already moved three trees away by the time the dogs smell that they went up this tree. Barking up the wrong tree, the psychology. The psychology of the entrepreneur is not the way, I think, to study entrepreneurship. It was dogma from Max Weber on that there was some sort of psychological change in people, or at least that we should search out the people in the society who have that psychology, that entrepreneurial psychology, and that that's how it works, and I don't think so. I think that all human populations have something like the same percentage of entrepreneurial psychology. It's the sociology, it's the acceptance of what I came to call by the end of this trilogy, commercially tested betterment. That's what made us rich. Good ideas to, one of the great ones is containerization, invented by a trucking company owner in North Carolina in 1956. Involved no science at all. Didn't involve a great deal of investment except in the gantry cranes to pick this stuff up. You pile up a bunch of corrugated steel boxes, and you're off to the races. The cost of ocean shipping fell gigantically below what it was before. So it's ideas that run the show. Capital is necessary, but, you know, so is, I don't know, air necessary. So is the arrow of time necessary. So is the existence of a labor force necessary. So it can't, you know, it's pouring capital into a country or a region doesn't necessarily make it prosperous and rich. As we saw in the case of Ghana. Ghana got tremendous amounts of foreign aid after independence. What we used to call Red China, not a cent. We're not going to give those commies anything. And of course, what that would mean is that Ghana would prosper and Red China would languish. It didn't happen. Ghana didn't grow rich, and investmentless Red China did. So that's the answer, so to speak. Well, then what's the sort? What's my claim? And this is a more narrow statement I'm about to make, because I'm going to go over to what I think the answer is. I've asked the question. I've said the kind of answer we need. The answer has to be about the whole economy, about innovation in particular. That's what we need to find out about with our studies of firms, companies, regions, nations, the world. You could take the view that Schumpeter does. I just did an essay on Schumpeter, so I had to read him again. Although, you know, you don't have to do that to write an essay. That's the advantage of being an essayist like I am. You just make it up out of your head, but I didn't this time. I read it. And he's got his famous notion that modern innovation becomes, so to speak, mechanized, routinized. Out of the great corporations, you have an innovation machine. And I can see the point, and in some cases it might be true, but on the whole, I don't think it is. I think innovation still depends on individual cleverness. I've been to as many of you doubtless have, to the tiny little museum they have at the Volvo factory in Göteborg. They have this wonderful exhibit of the two desks of the founder of Volvo, which means, of course, I roll. It was an offshoot of the great Swedish ball bearing company, of the two desks. One of the guys was a marketing business type guy, the other was an engineer. And their desks for their careers were put together. So they faced each other all day long. And out of that came Volvo. Well, that's a very individual, particular kind of source for this company. So my wider source is this, and it fits the Swedish case and now the Indian and the Chinese case, the South Korean case, the Irish case. The magic word here is liberalism. An inclusive liberalism is what I think made the modern world. A breakdown of hierarchy. Hierarchy of men over women, of the lord over the serf, although my people were Norwegian, so we didn't have any serfdom crap. The boss over the employee in a violent way. I mean, after all, in the 18th century, beating apprentices and employees was standard. That's what you did. You beat your wife, you beat your apprentice, you beat your sailors. Bang, bang, bang. Beat, beat, beat. Force, force, force. That broke down. We had a society increasingly of free people. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that I think that England, even now, is perfectly free. It's not, and certainly not my own country. But it was much freer than it was. And, yeah, go ahead.
Isn't it all about incentives?
What?
Isn't that all about incentives? The opportunity to consume, the possibility to consume the outcomes of your endeavors?
Well, I take Say's Law quite seriously. I don't think that demand could be the cause of the Industrial Revolution, or certainly not of the great enrichment that comes afterwards. Incentives matter. Look, I'm an economist. I'm even a Chicago School economist, though I've been everything. I've been a Keynesian. I've been an economic engineer. I've been everything. But I'm an Austrian drifting Chicago School economist. So I believe in incentives. I just don't believe that you can use incentives to explain the modern world, because there were plenty of incentives in China. If in 1492, if you had any sense, you'd bet on China as the place that would have such a thing as a great enrichment. It had better science, better laws, peace for centuries at a time, great cities, larger than anything in Europe. Talking about 1492. Come on. All the incentives, if all it was an approach to a pre-existing equilibrium, no problem. China should have been the place where the great enrichment happened. But it didn't. So although a market system and incentives and profits and so on have to exist, it's not the cause. The cause is human creativity. The creativity of the invention of the bandsaw, as I said, which I think is a Swedish invention, but if it wasn't a Swedish invention, it was used tremendously in Sweden and depended on high-quality steel, which the Swedes also made. So, understand, I'm not against economics. I'm not an English professor. I am an English professor, but I that doesn't mean I'm against incentives. But incentives by themselves, or capital by itself, or institutions by themselves, don't do it. What had to happen was a liberation of ordinary people. Joel Mokyr, my great friend, by the way, he had heart surgery. He's recovering very well from it. He didn't have a heart attack. He's in great shape. Joel thinks it's kind of an elite of engineers that made the modern world. And Joel and I argue about this. By now, science is really very important to our increased prosperity, further prosperity. You can't have a cell phone without electronics. But we do disagree on the kind of the initial phases of the great enrichment in the 19th century, which did not depend substantially on science, depended on technology. But those aren't the same necessarily as the case of containerization shows. So my argument is that it's the coming of liberalism, inclusive, egalitarian, allowing people, in the English phrase, we don't use it in the United States, allowing people to have a go. You know, the sporting metaphors are very important in Britain. And it's what happened in Sweden in the middle of the 19th century when it became liberal. It's what had happened centuries before in the Low Countries, especially what became the United Netherlands, and most particularly the province of Holland. And China and India right now make my case. Because China, though, to put it mildly, illiberal in politics, is liberal in its economy. All the land is owned by the government, but it's on 99-year leases. And then pretty much you're allowed to have a go. I have a colleague from Fudan University. When he came there as a freshman, a first-year student in 1981, there were two tall buildings in Shanghai, the Sheraton and the Hilton. Surprise, surprise. Now there are 2,000 buildings above 50 stories in Shanghai. That's a result of letting people go. Same things happened in India. After 40 years of trying to make what the Indians call, with sarcasm, the license Raj, where you had to have a license from the central planners to do anything. India, since 1991, has been moving in this, not perfectly, but moving substantially in this liberal direction. In both cases, economic growth went from essentially zero or 1% a year per capita in both countries, if it was positive, to anywhere from 6 to 10% per capita annually, which solves a lot of social problems. So I've made my point. Let me make one concluding point. How does this all happen? Well, the third volume, which I'm sure you'll rush out and order from Amazon, asks how did liberalism come to Europe, to Northwestern Europe in particular? And the answer is somewhat unsatisfactory, but it has the disadvantage of being true. So though it's not particularly economistic or clever, I think it's true, which is accidents of the politics of Europe in, say, the three centuries before 1800. The Reformation, but not for the reasons that Max Weber said, not because of some psychological change, but because of a sociological change when people, especially the radical Reformation, extreme case being the Quakers of the 17th century, who took their spiritual life in their own hands and then said, well, maybe we can do the economy with our own hands. It let people have a go. It inspirited people. The English Revolution, the Dutch 80 Years' War against Spain, the American Revolution, the glorious, so-called Glorious Revolution in Britain, the French Revolution, all of them inspirited ordinary people and made them think they could do it. Now, of course, there are other versions of this. For example, when Swedes, Norwegians, my Norwegian ancestors, and Swedes and Danes and Finns went to the United States, that was, so to speak, jumping into a circumstance in which they felt they had a go. They could have a go. But that's the story. It's the inspiriting of ordinary people It's liberalism, not socialism, not the government, not my favorite example of a crazy government project is the, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but the Göta Canal in Sweden. Am I saying it right? The canal that connects the Great Lakes and allows you to go from, I don't know, Gothenburg to Stockholm by, how's it?
Göta.
The Göta Canal was built by, dug by military conscripts over 20 years on the eve of the coming of the railway as a strategic measure. Yeah. So it was not the government, it was individuals. It was allowing people to be free. And so in the end, and here I will end and we can talk about all this, what made us rich did not corrupt us, was our freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We have some time for questions. We will pass around the microphone for those who want to ask questions. So we'll perhaps Raina can get us going.
Camera's not pointing at me anymore. Yes. Or is it?
Yes.
I'm like Donald Trump. I want the camera to be on me at all times. Pray for us. Oh, by the way, every speech I give in Europe or anywhere else, China, I should start by apologizing for Donald Trump. We are deeply sorry. We beg your forgiveness. Please.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It's not on.
Okay. Is it open?
No, it's not on.
It's not working. Let me see.
See what I mean?
Okay, let's
drives
see.
Me nuts.
Red light on the, no green.
Yeah, that's what I want to.
It's always worth checking the batteries. That's another problem. If the engineers here would move over to improving batteries, I would very much appreciate it.
Well, I don't know how to get this.
Is there any other one?
Let me see.
Because it's a large enough hall that it's going to be very hard to hear anyone.
Yes.
Is there anyone? Is there a technician here? Someone under 30?
Probably not.
I have a big boy. So.
Well, then turn towards them and say,
yes, please.
Not towards me. Don't look at me.
I hope you hear.
Good. Good voice.
Yes.
Say it to them, not to me. I'll be able to hear.
Thank you very much for this very interesting and thoughtful presentation.
Don't look at me.
I think your basic argument was very much similar what I read from Asimov Robinson's book, and they argue also that freedom from the centralist power of kingdom was very important to free the people to think about their potential. The parliamentarian system was their key aspect, as I understand, to the free thinking and use of human capital for innovations broadly in society. How do you think about this, the importance of their argument? Because it can be seen as one of the important means to get the ideas
I already have a microphone. I was going to take yours back. I don't think that institutions are it. I mean, my old colleague and friend Douglas North, institutions matter. And I think what he's missing and what Barry Weingast, who I've quarreled with in the Scandinavian Economic History Review recently. And Acemoglu, although, by the way, Acemoglu is not how his name is pronounced. I can never remember.
How do you pronounce it?
Beats me. It's Turkish spelling, but the Turks all laugh when you say Acemoglu. And Robinson, they all want some machinery. They want something that where click, 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 and the gears engage and the institutions do it. And the trouble is there's a lot of historical evidence that that's not so, which I go into in some detail in my books, especially the ones called Bourgeois Dignity, which is the most economic of my books, of these three, and in the last volume, which is called Bourgeois Equality. And I argue up and down against neo-institutionalism. It irritates me very much that Doug North, people say, well, you know, he won a Nobel Prize for that. And I say, no, he didn't. He won a Nobel Prize with Bob Fogel for inventing what we have come to call cleometrics. Sam and I invented the cleometric society. He got it for that. How do I know? I wrote the citation. So anyway, sorry, bad girl. Sorry, but institutions aren't it. But what does make it work is ethical change, rhetoric, self-image. And there you've got a direct line from a free society to innovation. If you know, I say, well, the balance of elites was overturned in North Weingast, North Wallace and Weingast. It's never altogether clear how that happens. But if you look at the pages where they talk about when the elites who were crushing innovation before stopped crushing it, you find that it's an ethical and rhetorical change that they're talking about. So I don't know how to respond to you. I should be more cooperative. I should say, oh, yeah, neo-institutionalism, that's where it is. But I think it's been a very misleading line in economic history.
But you need a reason for ethical change also.
Yes, you do, and that's why I have Volume 3, because there I have, but that's why I say it's unsatisfactory. It's not unsatisfactory to me, I think it's correct, but it's this accidents. It could have happened in China, maybe, or Japan, or the Ottoman Empire, or South Asia, the Indian subcontinent, but it didn't then. But it's happening now, in all those places. And it happened in Japan. Here's one way to think about it. In Europe, just take something we all know about Europe, the ideology was against innovation. It was against capitalists. It was against traders, merchants. We all know this. It's commonplace. The word innovation, I'd like to know how it is in other languages like Swedish or Finnish, but the very word innovation doesn't become positive in English until the 19th century. Innovations are, we don't want innovations. That might disturb, well, the interests of the elite or the church. And then innovation, gradually in the 18th century, you can see it starting to happen because the English become Dutch. The English and Scots adopt Dutch institutions in 1689, and they become, like the Dutch, favorable towards innovation, capitalism, we call it, although that's a terrible word for it, terrible misleading word. So look, I'd like to write maybe someday a book explaining once again why I don't like neo-institutionalism and why Acemoglu and Robinson are not on my, I don't hate them or something, but I'm sure they're very nice people, but you know, I don't think they're right.
Thank you, Professor. That was an absolute joy to listen.
Hold it close, like a rock musician. Yes. Think rock musician.
Am I audible?
Yeah, you can.
Thank you for that. I'm Sheetal from Bangalore, India. So I completely agree with your big point that liberalism is what helps. But I'm wondering why you said that the gross size of income is the biggest scientific problem and distribution isn't, because in India, you mentioned that after the 1990s, a lot of growth did happen, but a lot of the human miseries from the colonial times really still do persist. They don't get reported much because the press is free to not go to the villages.
I'm very worried by that kind of statement. I don't attack you personally, but I do worry about it. Look, when the Green Revolution happened in India, the left intellectuals opposed it. To a man and woman, they opposed it. And yet it made India, in short order, into a grain exporter. Having been on the edge of starvation for decades, I think it's a worry to worry too much about inequality too early. I mean, look, in Finland or the United States or Britain, you know, we're quite rich and okay, we can indulge this worry about the variance of income. As I said before, I think the main beneficiaries of fast economic growth are the poor, because the rich get another diamond bracelet. Well, good. Or another yacht. Well, that's too bad. That's kind of a vulgar thing to do. But the poor get adequate nutrition, health care, education, shelter, and that's a tremendous change from 1800 or 1900 in these countries. So I don't want to make the best the enemy, the unachievable best the enemy of the achievable good. What did Congress do? What was wrong with Nehru and the Gandhis in economic policy? They took London School of Economic Socialism and they applied it to India. You could say too early. You know, as I said, I was a Marxist once. I understand the argument. And the argument is this. The orthodox Marxist argument is that you've got to let capitalism go. Because what happens is that then capitalism, as Marx and Engels said in the manifesto, capitalism bears this fantastic fruit, which then you pluck for socialist purposes. So I know that it tires me out. I say income per head has increased by a factor of 30, 3,000%. And people say, well, what about the distribution? The boats have risen 100 meters. And people are saying, well, this one boat didn't get as high as the other. I worry about it. That's not how to fix the wretched of the earth. Redistributing income isn't how to do it. Look, I am a Christian liberal or a bleeding heart libertarian. I have a book that's coming out from Yale next year called that. So I believe that we have, as the Catholics say, a duty of a preferential option for the poor. Right? So you and I completely agree on that. But if we take the preferential option, as being, as alas, the Pope, contrary to all the popes since Leo the 13th, if we go the egalitarian socialist way, we wreck the poor. Don't get me started. We have a question right here.
So I have two questions. Because in your key points is that in the spirit of ordinary people and allow people to be free.
Yes.
But there are two countries, in my opinion, not quite free. One is China, one is Singapore.
They're but free?
I don't think so.
No, but you understand. Be careful. I mean economic freedom. That's all I mean. Both Singapore and China are not free in politics. So I agree with you. I don't have any problem. But it's not comprehensive liberalism. It's it's sufficient for economic growth that it be economic liberalism.
But to some extent, they are not necessarily free in their economics either. Because somehow the state-owned enterprises occupy maybe...
Alas.
95% of the economy?
No, they don't. Nothing like that. Not even close in China. You're wrong. That's the wrong number. But you're right that the state-owned enterprises and the kind of residual central planning impulses of the Central Committee are real threats to the continuation of this remarkable economic growth in China. There we are in agreement. But no, the state-owned enterprises if they're 30%, I'd be surprised. And they keep getting smaller because the non-state-owned enterprises, for example, real estate, the buildings in Shanghai, just to take one example, or Chengdu or anywhere else, they're growing like mad, and the state enterprises are failing. There's been a widespread belief in what Orban in Hungary frankly calls illiberal democracy. He thinks that's grand. And more central, although Hungary's a mixed case, but people always mention China and Singapore. They don't mention the other cases. On average, tyranny is bad for economic growth. I think we as economic and business historians, even in business, it's bad. In a free society, a tyrannical boss is not going to be successful. John D. Rockefeller, to take an example, was not tyrannical. He had a kind of funny-looking face, and people thought he was mean. But he wasn't. He was a consultative, cooperating CEO. And, by the way, owner. So it's not the case that, on average, tyranny does very badly. Take Eastern Europe. Take 100 other examples. Take Zimbabwe next door to Botswana. Botswana is a free country, has a free economy. It's doing quite well. By the way, sub-Saharan Africa in general is starting to grow, praise the Lord. Whereas Zim, it's a mess. Because if you're very lucky, you get the guy who is in charge of Singapore, and his son seems okay too. If you're unlucky, you get Mugabe. And usually the luck, there was a famous historian who said, power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So let's look at the economic side of it. Now, my big hope for the future is India. Because India is crazy, but it's a democracy. And they play very good cricket. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think your argument is quite right in terms of the enterprise's activity. But if you look at how the credit side, all the banking credit is detected by the government.
Banking is a bit of a problem in China. I agree with you. Yeah, there I agree. And China, you know, I'm worried. Xi is a tyrant. And there have been some decisions that the Chinese have made, economic decisions, which I don't think are so smart. I've been on the high-speed rail in China. It's amazing. It has even more than Spain does. Spain got high-speed rail with German interest rates, and it's a disaster. And I think it's probably a disaster in China in cost-benefit terms. You need market-tested betterment. It's got to be better than the what you did before, and it can't be decided by some tyrant, or else he or she is going to make a mistake. Yeah. Hold it close like rock music.
Okay, I will.
Good, there, you got it.
I really loved all elements of your talk, but it made me think when you said that part of what was important was allowing people to have a go.
Yes.
That even before that, a key thing was allowing people to have an idea.
Yes.
And I wondered if you had any view, and this is totally revealing a British bias,
yep,
but if you thought that humor had a role to play, then instead of responding to people's ideas by shutting them up, we just used humor.
I was just at a conference where David Hume was the big hero in Holland. We were talking about Adam Smith, by the way, Adam Smith and Hume and the Scottish Enlightenment generally, we were talking about economics, not about economic growth. But yeah, I think free speech, and that's another worry about China, because there's no question that there's no free speech in China. Just try and mention Tiananmen Square on your email and see what happens. But it's those accidents. I said church governance was the big thing in the Reformation, but another eventually consequence of the Reformation, although God knows it wasn't the immediate consequence, was toleration. By the end of the 17th century, the standard analysis is exhausted from killing each other, Sweden being the most extreme example. They said, oh, God, oh, okay, go on being Protestants, Catholics, I don't care. I'm sick to death of it. And that was a, and then David Hume was a symbol of this. Although, you know, he didn't get a university appointment because the Ayatollahs of the Presbyterian Church prevented it. But even towards the end of the 18th century, even people like David Hume could get university appointments in Scotland.
Yeah. Okay. Hello?
I can't see you. Would you put your hand up? Oh, there you are.
Okay, does this work?
It does work, and if you hold it close like you're doing, it's going to be great.
Okay. I think this idea I got from Eric Jones, but if I've got it screwed up, don't blame him.
Oh, no. Eric's one of my allies, partly.
He seems to have an idea that the urge to innovate and change has always been with us.
Exactly.
And he places like Sung China and Aegina in Greece.
Yep.
That there's always been, and yep, this is where I think I may be wrong. The governments or the ruling classes always want to prevent it because they fear the innovation will destroy them. And somehow the places that escape from that.
Well, Eric's my guru, although he doesn't acknowledge it. He was the pioneer in all this, and I admire him very much.
Then I didn't get it wrong.
No, I don't think you got it wrong. I think it tends towards this mechanical stuff that Doug and Barry and so forth want to put forward. And actually, in this controversy I had with Barry in the Scandinavian Economic History Review, he did say, and I congratulated him for it, that liberalism mattered a great deal, this ideological change. But they don't emphasize it enough, and neither did Eric. Although I learned from Eric, for example, that English courts stopped enforcing guild exclusiveness in the 1730s and 40s. Now, guilds were very powerful in Germany, France, not so powerful in the Low Countries and England. But in any case, if you were going to innovate, you needed, wool textiles or something else, you needed to get the permission of the local guild. And in order for that to work, there had to be exclusive guild monopolies in each town. And English courts, English judges, Eric educates me in this, stopped enforcing it. So the guilds couldn't go to law. So guilds became very weak in England in the 18th century. And that's a good thing, because government-sponsored monopolies are the main problem of monopoly. It's not, natural monopolies, which are kind of a myth, but it's government monopolies, taxis. In Finland, have you allowed Uber? Is there Uber in Finland? Answer me. It's illegal, right? Until July?
Yes.
Then they're going to allow it. Yes. Praise the Lord.
Okay, I think you answered my question.
Well, I don't know if I answered it, but I talked around it. I want Anne to tell me that I've got it all wrong for Nederland.
Thank you, Deirdre, as always. As I think you know, I am inclined to agree with you a great deal on the fortuitous and beneficial, sort of efflorescence capacitizingness, if I can make up that word,
good way to put
of liberalism and liberal values, and in particular of letting women, half of the world's population, have
a go.
And it gives people ideas about other kinds of marginalized people at the same
time. Exactly.
But my question is the following. Once you get the innovation in some places that liberalism percolates, everyone else can see it.
Yep, that's right.
Whether they are liberal or not.
That's
and it
trouble.
Seems to me that your great question, well answered, in my opinion, has a second question, which is why are places either stymied or stymied themselves in not following when ideas are very hard to keep, ideas are very hard to keep secret.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so it seems to me there's a second half to this question.
Yeah, it's not
the original question.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's a critical question for the current disparity.
You're right, and it's a very deep and important point. Here's how I'm going to do this year. Watch me. I'm going to write a technical economic piece. I think I'm going to use biological mathematics, and it's going to be called How Growth Starts, because that's what I've been talking about, how growth starts. But the point you're making is that once you have electric lights and cheap steel and so on, it seems that it's rather easy to imitate. And you'd think that the whole world would be developed by now, to go back to Easterlin's, the title of his, this is a famous paper, and he kind of, why isn't the whole world developed? And Dick Easterlin said, it's about education or human capital. I think he's wrong there, but still, it's a very good question. And I haven't got any snappy answer to it. All I know is this. When I was young, as some of the audience here are now, we were told in my economic and historical education that, say, India would never develop because, after all, they're all Hindus. Or China would never develop because, they're all Confucians or communists or something beginning with C. And that was the line in economic development in the 50s and 60s. Even so admirable a person as the Hungarian, I'm going to forget his name, the liberal development specialist from Hungary, educated at Cambridge. What is his name? What? No, no, he's a friend of mine. I just saw him a few weeks ago. No, no, not that. This is way before. What is his name? I wrote an essay on him just a few months ago. Anyway, I've forgotten his name. But he, even he thought that this cultural thing was what caused what you're asking about. Why didn't electric lights spring up in Indian villages, as they, in some cases, still haven't? Well, that's a question I don't know how to answer. I know how it started.
I have some
theories.
I've
got it right.
We'll talk.
Yeah. Do, please, help me. Save me. Save me from my ignorance. You know, I don't want to give you the impression that this all snaps shut and I'm claiming that I know economic history, how it works, and so on and so forth. But I am urging you to make sure that in your micro studies that we're facing the right questions, that we're not just looking at how one company succeeds compared to another, that we're trying to look for the basic causes of the wealth of nations. Yes.
Yes. Thank you for the great discussion. And I have a fundamental question. Please excuse me if it's already been answered.
I'll judge you whether it's fundamental. And, sorry.
So what you're saying is that we become richer by freedom. And,
yeah.
People are...
Via innovation.
People in the world are becoming freer as we speak, and more people will have a go.
Yep.
And we will, as a whole, become richer as well.
The whole world.
Exactly. And I quite agree with your point on not worrying about the distribution too early.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
Makes sense. But how about now, and how about in the future, the question of sustainability? We in the Western world, we've had a go for centuries already.
Yep.
Is it time to limit our freedom, economic freedom in some way, or can the world still carry the whole net gain in all parts of the world?
Well, it's you can view your question as the environmental question and so on. And I don't sneer at that at all. I'm very concerned about global warming. I don't know if most people here, I guess, are. And I think we ought to do something about it. On the other end, I don't think closing down industrial civilization or stopping India and China from developing, which we can't anyway, even if we bombed them, we couldn't stop it. I think that, well, I got two kinds of answers. One is that I'm optimistic about solving environmental problems. I really do think that we're on to a number of ways of solving them, and eventually will. I expect that in 20 or 30 years, there'll be a very sharp decline, steady decline, in the use of carbon-based energy. And that's why I want the engineers to fix the batteries. Come on, we got to get on to that. But they're working on it. They're very interested in it. But I want to warn you, the same way I warned my colleague here, that we don't want to make a vague fear about the environment the enemy of progress that could solve it in the end. And I think we have to be careful about that. You can take the... I've observed, perhaps you have too, that the environmentalists, the real environmentalists, the biologists and so on, are really wholly ignorant of economics. The most extreme case is, what's his name? The population bomb, what is his name? Let's say it so I can hear it. Paul Ehrlich. When was it, 1969 or something? He said, the battle for the future is over. Mass starvation will come to the world, and By now, we'd all be dead or very hungry. And it really didn't happen at all. It didn't come close to happening. Population continued to grow, although it's steadily slowing in growth. The prospect is that it'll peak in about 30 years at 10 billion and then start falling. I just don't think that Malthusian concerns, population growth, or even environmental concerns are, well, as we say in English law, dispositive. That is, I don't think they settle the issue against economic growth. Especially economic growth that's not kind of extensive and just piling capital on top of capital, but is about ingenuity, about thinking up new stuff. So you can say I'm a hopeless optimist, but as Thomas Babington Macaulay said in 1830, he said, people say that our best years are behind us, that, now this is 1830, that we're all going to, that population growth is going to overcome us and that we're all going to starve to death. But I predict that in 1930, we will have machines such as we've never had before in every household in Britain, that the population of this United Kingdom will be, three times more, or four times more than it is now, yet will be prosperous. And his estimate of the population, if you include the Ireland, which had recently parted from the United Kingdom, was more or less exactly correct. And the prosperity of 1930 was vastly greater than in 1830. So he said, why, and this seems to me the merest of common sense, why when all behind us, now he was a Whig, the typical Whig historian, so he thought we were all always getting better, but why when all that's happened since 1800 is that we've gotten better off, you know, the business cycle is just scallops and income keeps going up. Why would we think that, why would sheer pessimism overcome us? Sorry, I tend to give long answers to short questions. I wish I could give short answers.
All right. I think we're just about out of time, so this is perfect. I wanted to, first of all, remind you we'll have some drinks outside, some herbs and goodies. So, but before we get to all that stuff, I want to give our speaker one more time.